just going to offer a brief reflection and then we can open it up for questions, comments. There was a question last week about the impact of emotions or beliefs from earlier in our lives on how we perceive or how we relate in conversations, what our experiences are. And I was reflecting on that today and recollecting that emotional responses, especially strong ones, usually are tied to what in Buddhist parlance is view or views. And in particular, implicit beliefs, views we might not see clearly as like, I believe this, but just something that's assumed to be true. And they're often shaped, almost always shaped early in life by family, culture, and by other kinds of life experiences, particularly extremely pleasant or unpleasant life experiences. Those tend to leave a strong imprint in the heart and mind, strong conditioning. These views can be like the water a fish swims in, or like the air we breathe, just not really noticeable until maybe there's a problem, a breakdown of some kind. In the Buddhist framework of the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, views fit in to the same kind of categorization as all thoughts and all emotions, and for that matter, perceptions too, which all of those are called formations, which is a word that basically just means, in this context anyway, mental phenomena of one kind or another. And views have a bit of a unique spot in that sort of scheme because they literally can shape what we see and what we don't see. If I have a view something isn't important, I might not even notice it at all, whether it's another person, an animal, a building, whatever. They also shape how we judge things or people or ideas or events. So, an implicit view informs what we might think is right or wrong, good or bad, even valid or invalid. So, often, if strong emotions come up in a conversation, when watching or listening or reading media, can almost guarantee that a couple of things are happening. One is that whatever one is reading runs into a view of some kind that's being held. And often, if there's a strong response, it's either something about something I really, really want, or it's something that is in some way threatening to that view, and then by extension to my identity or some aspect of my identity, whether it's being a good Buddhist or a good daughter or a good sister or a good friend, whatever that is. To the extent I am needing myself or my views to be a certain way, and I'm unable to tolerate a difference from that. And this is deep stuff, right? Where it's not like we necessarily decide this. To that extent is the amount that a strong emotion will often come up. And to be clear, some of these views can't be seen very easily, right? I might have the view that because someone's gender is X, that means Y, or that ethnicity, race, culture have some kind of ranking. And that will inform the way I draw in information and the way I respond to what information I'm even able to see. So, practicing with views, beliefs, judgments is advanced practice in some ways. As far as the practice of open awareness or awareness of awareness, receptive awareness goes, one of the most helpful things I've found is, well, first to go to the body. So if I'm feeling tension, new tension, heat, reactivity in the body, that's a clue to finding an emotion, and that is a clue to finding a view. It's almost like a breadcrumb trail I can trace back, an opinion, right? So that's one way. Another way is stepping back. And by that, I mean, if I'm noticing strong reactivity, I might just get interested in the fact that it's happening rather than what I'm being reactive about. And I can think of this recently. Someone said something that just poked an old wound. It really, really hurt. And after the ouch, there was a choice point for me. I could either go into the story of how this person was awful, or I could go into, why did that hurt so much? And not, I'm not talking about analytics here. I'm talking about, okay, what was the cascade that happened just now that made that hurt? And then, if I notice that, okay, what that person said popped up a story in the mind, and the story threatened a piece of my identity. Okay. Bringing kind attention to that and just holding it kindly. Often it's more than kind, it's compassion, because in these moments, there's some kind of reactivity happening. I guess the other piece I find helpful is practice with a sense of humor. And I talked about this a little bit last week, but bringing a believability scale or a believability index to whatever is happening in my head in that moment. And the shortcut for that is, well, on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being completely ludicrous and 10 being totally accurate, where is it on that scale? And a good test for this sometimes is to say it out loud to a friend, exactly as you're thinking it. And sometimes before the sentence is even completely out of my mouth, I realize just how ridiculous my mind has become, right? So, those are some possibilities. The Buddha doesn't ask us not to have views. He asks us not to cling to them. So it's impossible to make our way through life, right, without some kind of view or another. We all need to posit beliefs about the world to move through the world. So the notion is not like clinging to views is actually one of the four fetters, sometimes called the fourth root of suffering. And it is the last one to go away before complete and perfect enlightenment, which should give us a clue that it's really buried in there, right? So to be gentle with yourself when these come up and cause suffering. They can change, they can be let go of, but the underlying tendency, it is human, right? Maybe I will stop there for a minute and see if there are any questions and comments. And if not, I can keep going on a related topic. But just want to check in with you guys and see. If you have questions about that, or if you have questions about your practice or other questions you want to bring. And let me allow you to unmute. I think I turned that off. Yes, you can now speak if you wish. Fred, please.
Yes, I wanted to let you know that I have been practicing with your believability index during this past week. And I have found it a very useful way of categorizing ideas that happen. And thank you for that.
Wonderful. Thank you, Fred. I'm glad it's helpful. Andrea had introduced it to me probably close to 10 years ago now, and I found it really helpful too when I first started. I still find it helpful, clearly, because I'm talking about it. Yes, Ali, please.
Hi. Thank you for opening this subject and looking at it. What I was also wondering about, I don't know, these are some of the reflections I have, maybe you can comment on them. But there are some points earlier in life that there are like emotions that they come up that perhaps no cultural views or family views have been established. Maybe jealousy or some of the other emotions that are deep. And then for lack of my knowledge, I'll say like, and then we have like defense mechanisms, and then the thoughts come in after the emotions are triggered. And then the other thing is that, I mean, and then throughout life, when we grow up, then those things become memory, and then we pack more on those memories, and then the memory comes up in a present moment, duplicating the past event. I'm not, I mean, I see how view can be related to the, I mean, I'm sorry, the emotion can be related to the view and the belief system. But at the earlier, like those raw things, who knows where those come from? It could just stand alone by itself. I'm not sure. I was just wondering if you can reflect on those three emotions alone with the memory, and then, yeah, that's all.
So I can reflect on that. I want to just name that it's going to diverge a little bit from sort of a dharmic reflection to do that. So I can give you my personal perspective on it, but not being a psychologist and not being an expert on emotion, it's worth what you're paying for it. What I will say is, I think there's, from a scientific perspective, an emotion is actually a very fleeting event. It happens, and it's like there's a certain number of seconds. I believe it's 60 seconds. If we don't refresh the emotion, if we don't feed it again, its half-life is actually quite short in the mind and heart. Now, its half-life in the body can be longer depending on what it is, like panic, for example. We've all had that, and it takes a while for the body mind to settle down. That's not to say they're not significant, right? Especially repeated exposure to emotion like that can lay down a habitual conditions, a habitual way of responding. That then, and this is what I hear you saying, can then be projected onto current events if it's been layered into memory. And it almost doesn't matter what the current event is, because it's like I was talking about perceptions before, right? Emotions color perceptions just as much, if not more, than views do. And so, like, I don't know if any of you have had this experience, but if I've been in a certain frame of mind, let's say angry or fearful about an interaction I'm having with someone through email, I may get an email when I'm in that state and I will read it and I'll have a very strong reaction to it. Now, what's extremely humbling about this is, let's say one has the presence of mind not to write a reply and hit send, but walks away from the computer and comes back later, level-headed. I have actually noticed that I've completely misread text. Like, I have reshaped words and sentences based on what is in here and what is in here. It is phenomenal. So that's a little bit of an example, Ali, I think, of what you're talking about. It's like the frame of mind, the emotion is so strong that all of the input is distorted, diluted to match the frame of mind and heart. So absolutely, I think those layers do have a play. And for myself, I've found intermittent periods of working with a psychologist to be helpful to dig back down into the history. That's not something Buddhism is as good at solving. Yeah. So,
okay.
Is that helpful at all?
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, sure.
Yeah. One way that this practice can be really helpful is in noticing, and you're noticing this, there's a conditionality, right? So noticing the chain of conditions that causes one of these shifts of like having the emotion layered on the present life. I'm just going to call that a projection. It's not maybe quite the right word, but noticing, okay, what starts this chain reaction? And what's the next step? And what's the next step? And that's a way of disidentifying with it and stepping back into that wisdom perspective and just allowing it to cascade. And there's something healing about seeing that happen. Part of it seems to be that one is not as caught up in the story that way. If it becomes a series of events, it's a series of events. And then it's no longer the truth with a capital T, right? So to notice the interlocking conditions maybe that are leading to whatever your flavor of this very human issue is. Thank you, Ellie. It's a great question. And I've still got it flagged for Andrea. So.
Okay. Thank you.
You're welcome. Any other questions or comments? Thoughts about this practice? Thoughts about what we've said so far? Yes, Sue, please.
Yeah, I wasn't able to make it last week, but I did listen to your talk afterwards, and I'm glad I did because I actually knew what Fred was talking about when you talked about the about the rating scale, and that sounds like it's very useful, and I'm definitely going to try that. Wanted to say that I appreciated the meditation tonight. I was in Andrea's retreat a couple weeks ago. Mm-hmm. Which was based on this practice. And I don't know if it's ever really going to become my primary practice the way it has for her. But this was a good reminder that I do want to return to it every now and then. And it was very, very, very useful for me. So thank you for doing that tonight.
You're welcome. And I really appreciate that you do want to come back and revisit it now and then.
Mm-hmm.
Something that's been really helpful for me is it is one of my primary practices. And part of the way it's able to be one of the primary practices is that I feel like this form of practice can hold any of the others. So like when I open up, if the mind wants to be in with the breath, that's just part of what's being received.
Yeah.
And that gradually expands to fill more of awareness. But there's something about the stability of a larger field that for this mind anyway, I find really helpful. The same is true with metta practice. Like sometimes the mind just wants to be chanting the Metta Sutta in the background. Okay, that's lovely. Let it happen. So it's like you almost kind of don't have to pick. You can just allow them to meld together and see what is it that you have found most striking for you since the retreat, as far as like either going back to the way you were practicing or what's been coming up?
Well, actually, it has been kind of a melding, and I think that that's probably what I'm going to be doing in the future. I originally came from Zen practice, and one of the things I could relate to the most then there was the concept of bare awareness, you know, which is very similar in a way. I mean, I never could get into things like Cohen practice, I think that this on some level it is always going to be part of my practice now.
Wonderful. And I agree, there's definitely a similarity between the open receptive awareness practice and Zen practice, no question. Thank you, Sue. Any other thoughts or questions? Yes, Ali, please.
If nobody else wants to go, I have always tons of questions. No answers, but I mean, better answers. Yeah. Thank you. With open awareness, when the mind gets like intrigued in the some story that the mind, is creating, are we following that or with the awareness? I know, there are like times that we're daydreaming, so it's impossible to notice that. But and then the other part of that is that when I notice the thought, if I'm staying with the mind, if I understand it correctly with the open awareness, if I'm standing with the mind, this observing where the mind goes, at that stop, at the moment that I observe it, then it doesn't follow it. I mean, it stops the thinking. I mean, I don't know if you have any, or if I'm making any sense or, yeah.
You are. This is hard stuff to talk about. So it can be different at different phases of practice and different with different qualities of attention. So absolutely, like thoughts are kind of, for all their power, for all their presumed authority, they can be very shy. So if the attention is aimed at them like a kind of like a bright searchlight, it's almost like, I don't know, little critters that scamper out of the way or something, right? So it takes a very, very sort of soft, subtle back focus that can allow even daydreaming to happen and to be aware of the fact that daydreaming is happening. Sayadaw Utejaniya sometimes calls this 50-50 mindfulness. It's like you're half in the content and half observing. I actually kind of prefer 360-degree mindfulness. To me, that feels more evocative of like, yeah, the thought can go through, the emotion can go through. It's actually super helpful if I'm aware of at least some of the content or at least the mood of it, because then the discernment can be made. Is this helpful to allow to be attended to, or should this sort of be noticed as unhelpful in the mind? Because that is a discernment. It's not like you have to do anything. The discernment itself will help train your heart and train your mind towards more and more beneficial ways of thinking and being. So it's also totally normal when you become aware that things stop. Right? That's fine too. It's just notice, okay, thought stopped. It will start again, I guarantee it, as long as you're alive.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So we might have time for one more question, or I can riff a little bit on the... Oh, Bob, please. I see you.
Hi.
Hi.
I have two questions. One is, what is after your name and she?
Okay.
That's one.
I'll take that one first. That's easy. So it's Ramaytush Ohlone Land, and that is the name of the Indigenous American tribal nation that was occupying the area of the peninsula, the San Francisco Peninsula, before colonizers came.
Okay. And are you descended from those people?
I am not. And you'll notice there are other people, both in this Zoom room and many other Zoom rooms, who have these. So there's a tradition among many Indigenous peoples, but Indigenous peoples of North America in particular, to honor the land that they're on and the history of the land. So it's become a way for other people to acknowledge that, to put it in. It's an acknowledgement and sort of a bow to the people that have been here a lot longer than we have. So that's my understanding. Maybe other people have other understandings about it.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
The other thing is not a question so much as an observation mm-hmm. on my part. And it's that as I was sitting in open awareness tonight, whatever comes up, I accept as something that's come up, and I just kind of have an attitude towards it, like, oh, hi. It's like a person or something else has appeared before me. Oh, hi. And that attitude of acceptance and friendliness, I think, is very important to not holding on, not latching on to and embellishing whatever came up. And I have to very much agree with you that these things hardly last seconds, sometimes not even. And whereas I used to be disturbed that they would come up and that I would try to deal with them in a way that was rejecting, then that did not work out too well. And it's much easier to do that and not necessarily get into the binary state of, oh, I'm doing poorly or I'm doing badly or I'm doing really well. I had a great, great meditation, you know, that kind of thing.
Beautiful. You just said it so beautifully. Yeah. Friendly acknowledgement, friendly acceptance. It's one of the very wise attitudes. And I'm hearing something else in what you're saying too, which is a kind of equanimity in it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So wonderful. That's one of the flavors of wise attitude for sure. And may we all develop more flavors of wise attitude. So friends, I'm going to just really quickly dedicate the merit. Thank you all so much for your practice. It's lovely to be with you. May all beings everywhere benefit from the practice here tonight. May all beings be happy, be safe, and may all beings know the highest bliss of freedom. Thank you all so much for your practice. I'm sending a brief chat with information about a few upcoming teachings I've got. There's also one that is happening, I believe it's a month from today, at Coastside Vipassana, which I did not put in there, but actually a little bit less than a month from today. So if those are of interest, please feel free to come, and it's wonderful to see you all. Good night.
Thank you. Good night.
You're well. Bye.
Thank you, Dawn.
Welcome.